are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, May 30th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of History at Yale University, Timothy Snyder, on tyranny. Also on the program today, staff shakeup at White House. The communications director resigns. Who knew they had one?
I had no idea who he was.
Meanwhile, Republicans in state houses begin to be inspired by Gianforte as two dead, one injured, as an anti-Islamic extremist goes on a stabbing spree. Also on the program today, CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina speaks on the Republicans' continuing sabotage of Obamacare. And in the wake of Trump's first foreign policy trip, it is the end of the post-World War II era of European stability. Meanwhile, Oklahoma, it's the new Kansas, as tax cuts devastate education. Trump administration rolling back civil rights enforcement throughout our government agencies. All this and more on today's program. Also, I should say, brief note, Manuel Noriega has passed away.
Rest in peace.
Well,
great guy.
There's some question as to whether or not it is a delayed response to all of the heavy metal music he was subjected to when he was barricaded in his compound in Panama. Do you even know what I'm talking about, Matt?
Seriously? Is that really not true?
Do you not know what I'm talking about? Do you know who Manuel Noriega is?
Yeah, I do, but I know the name, but I don't know specifically his history.
You know
what country he ran?
Well, Panama.
Panama, but I just
Will
said
Panama.
That. George H.W. Bush, who back in the day, palled around with Noriega. We don't know exactly what they did, although Noriega claimed at the time that he had George Herbert Walker Bush by the testicles. I don't know if he used that word. He may have said huevos. And we invaded Panama.
And was it 87 or 88? Do you know what year?
I believe it must have been after 88.
Oh, because it was a Bush operation.
Yes. And to get him out, to basically wear him out as he was barricaded in the Panamanian version, I guess, of the White House, military forces played Guns N' Roses.
Van Halen?
I think it was Panama.
Right.
Actually, they kept playing. And my friend Larry reminded me of that.
Little something learned in CIA school.
Well, the amazing thing about that is that just sounds like a normal Two for Tuesday and Worcester Radio.
Right.
Like, that's...
You just throw in some, like, obnoxious jocks in the middle.
I mean, honestly, the idea that you would, like, I can't stand this rock and roll music is so loud, just seems like apartment living. But nevertheless, Noriega came out, went to jail, and died today, or I guess maybe over the weekend, at 83.
And he was basically the narco banker for everybody, the CIA, Pablo Escobar, like that was his function.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really dig into it, but it's not quite clear to me why we didn't hear more about Herbert Walker Bush. But after that, in terms of his relationship to Noriega.
I feel like Matt might have a little bit of tunnel vision on his historical things, you know, picks and chooses.
Well, we all do in our own ways. I want to just, there's a couple of stories that caught my eye in the context of having Timothy Snyder on today. You may have seen his Facebook post that came out like within days after the election, which was 20 lessons from the 20th century on how to fight tyranny. And that's what ultimately became the book. And I think we've tried to book him off and on over the course of the past now 5 or 6 months. Sometimes thinking like, is this too much? I mean, is this being alarmist or not alarmist? But when you start to hear stories like this out of Portland, and we also have one out of Texas too, but we're just going to talk about the Portland one. And this is in the wake of the dual stabbing, on a light rail train, where a guy, Jeremy Christian, was harassing. We're not going to play this video now, but where a guy, Jeremy Christian, was harassing and maybe threatening two women who, I guess, maybe they're wearing hijabs, or I'm not sure. But they looked Muslim to this guy. And then other passengers on the train basically told the guy to lay off. And he went on to stab three people at least, killing two, stabbing them in the neck, apparently. This Jeremy Christian, allegedly, I guess, to be fair. Michael has an interview tomorrow with someone who's actually interviewed this guy. He is a white supremacist. And what happened was there apparently was going to be some type of white supremacy parade. And it was, or a parade where white supremacists were going to march. And it was, there was a sense in the city that Antifa were going to in some way confront these people. So the Multnomah County GOP chair, James Buchal, I may be mispronouncing that, told the Guardian paper that recent street protests had prompted Portland Republicans to consider alternatives to abandoning the public square. Now, apparently, I don't know if these, if white supremacists, you know, according to this guy, are, you know, the Republicans. But he says, I'm sort of evolving to the point where I think it's appropriate for Republicans to continue to go out there. And if they need to have security force protecting them, that's an appropriate thing, too. And he said, does this mean you're going to rely on your own security arrangements rather than relying on city or state police? Yeah. And there are these people arising, like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters. We're thinking about that because there are now belligerent, unstable people who are convinced that Republicans are like Nazis. And I should tell you, the Oath Keepers, of course, are like this ultra fundamentalist Christian group made up of a lot of like ex-military and ex-policemen, among other things. The Three Percenters is a spinoff from the Oath Keepers. Founded in response to the election of Barack Obama, they're basically some type of like paramilitary group that pledges armed resistance against attempts to restrict private gun ownership. This is as described by the Political Research Associates. They were highly visible during that right-wing militia takeover of the wildlife refuge in Oregon. So when you start hearing about Republican officials welcoming these type of people as security forces, you start to hear echoes of things that are a little problematic. A little bit. Just a little bit. When you start to see what happened in Texas, a Texas state representative, referring to protesters who were protesting basically a ban on sanctuary cities, making local authorities contact federal immigration authorities if they come across any people, regardless of how they come across. It could be, oh, we got a phone call and took a witness statement from someone who is in the country without documentation or has overstayed their visa, whatever it was, and report those people to ICE. Recall, ICE has now increased its arrests in the past, since the new administration, by almost 50%. And most of those people are not people who are here because they have committed some other, what we would consider, crime. ICE now officially perceives being here without the proper documentation as being a crime that justifies pursuit, as opposed to being someone who's engaged in violent crime. And so apparently, on the House floor, Representative Matt Rinaldi, a Republican, after these protesters were chanting, said that he had reported to the people up into the who were protesting to immigrations, to ICE, and said, we're going to have them deported, and then used an obscenity. We were in shock, said Cesar Blanco. He assumed that because they were brown in the gallery and protesting, that they were here illegally. The exchange led to a confrontation among lawmakers, and we could play some of the video of it. There's really nothing to hear, but you can see them shoving. And this is like the type of image. Go ahead, Matt. This is the type of image that, you know, we've looked at stuff like this from, like, hey, this looks like the parliament in, I don't know, Bulgaria or something, right? I mean, you know, you see those type of things.
Yes.
Not traditionally what you see in state houses. And apparently, Mr. Rinaldi wrote a Facebook post claiming that I made it clear to him that if he attempted, in his words, to get me, I would shoot him in self-defense. But according to lawmakers who heard this Republican, said that his threat to Mr. Navarez, who represents Eagle Pass, a city on the Texas-Mexico border, the threat was a little more pointed. There was a threat made from Rinaldi to put a bullet in one of my colleague's head. This is according to Representative Justin Rodriguez. Mr. Navarez said on Twitter he never threatened Rinaldi, the Republican. He's a liar and a hateful man. Got no use for him. God bless him. So, I mean, you're starting to see this type of stuff where you're using ICE as a means of silencing protests if it's done by brown people. Last week, we saw a cop who came upon a guy who was hit by a car on his bike. First thing he asked him, are you illegal?
Oh, my God.
Because his skin color was brown. Because maybe he spoke Spanish, like millions of Americans do. So this type of stuff is scary. And let's take a quick break. We'll talk to, Professor Timothy Snyder in a moment and get his take on this. In the meantime, I should tell you, I went to California last week. I went to L.A. I wasn't going to say it, but I couldn't say it on Friday because it was my friend's surprise birthday party and he listens to the show. And so he was vaguely suspicious, but not that suspicious.
I think we played it well, I think.
What?
I think we played it well.
He got suspicious?
Well, I mean, I wasn't here
mysterious
on a Friday.
Location that doesn't, and he listened.
So
a mysterious
what?
Location.
Well, he's very tuned in to your antics, I
guess. Yeah, yeah. That's why I didn't want to go on Skype with video. Because, like, there's no way I could not make it look like my sister's apartment, which looks very... You know,
LA.
Los Feliz-y, Silver Lake-y.
Ah.
Yeah. In a good way. In
she's
a good
like
way.
She's like an artist.
Yes. Yes. She's a little boheme.
And that's texture.
Well, my point is, I flew out to California.
Yes.
5-hour ride. Oh, what do you do? Oh, darn it. I got nothing to read
because I
didn't buy
what
a magazine. I could buy 40 magazines.
Social Security.
Wait a second. I could buy 40 magazines at the, the little store they got in the airport and lug those onto the airplane, or I could just use my Texture app. And I ended up reading. And for me, the thing I like about Texture is that I don't read the normal things that I normally read. They've got 200 magazines. So I'll browse through Consumer Reports. I'll check up on my family handyman. Hey, look at this. They have a new type of heating system, or this would be the best way to make a shed. I do read that stuff.
We know.
I build up like a base of knowledge for building. Vanity Fair. I even browse through some stuff on backpackers.
Oh, there you go.
And I can guarantee you, I will not go backpacking probably again in my life. Nevertheless, that's all thanks to Texture. Texture's daily recommendations and exclusive interactive features. You can easily pinpoint the articles that you want to read, not necessarily me, although I would recommend Family Handyman. Plus, Texture is searchable, so you can mark what you like, check out old issues, or view bonus video content seamlessly. Everything from National Geographic to Fast Company to Rolling Stone, New Yorker, New York is available. Wired, I'm just thinking of the magazine, on the Texture app, which was selected as one of Apple's top 2016 iPad apps. Texture is normally $9.99 a month, which is a great deal. But if you sign up right now at texture.com/majority, you get a 14-day free trial. Don't be ridiculous. Just check it out. You're going to love it. 14 days to try Texture for free when you go to texture.com/majority. Texture.com/majority. Quick break. Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program the Levin Professor of History from Yale University and author of multiple books, including Black Earth and his recent On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, Timothy Snyder. Welcome to the program, Timothy.
Very glad to be talking to you.
This book, On Tyranny, basically grew out of both your experience of being a historian of Eastern and Central Europe and from posting basically lessons that you have learned from that history in terms of avoiding tyranny on a Facebook post. But I want to start just a little bit before that and give us a sense of like what are the most obvious or I guess and some of the most surprising examples of tyranny and slash maybe fascism that you have studied through the years. Obviously, Germany in pre-World War II, but where else?
So maybe because this is what I work on, my own optic is a little bit different. So I wouldn't describe any of it as surprising. I tend to think that the survival of, you know, pluralist institutions and rule of law states like our own is surprising, and that we should appreciate those things and work hard to keep them going. But I appreciate the generous question about what I've worked on. I I've worked on both the far right and the far left. I've worked on the Soviet Union and its policies of terror, including famine, as well as the mass killings of the Great Terror, as well as some of the atrocities committed by the Soviet side during the Second World War. I've also worked on the far right, on Nazi Germany, on German policies of killing, which included, of course, the handicapped, and prisoners of war, as well as the better known case, which is, of course, the Holocaust. And I think maybe because I've worked on both the far right and the far left, it's the sort of that it's the pressure, it's the center, which I find, you know, elusive and hard to hold on to and worth thinking about and worth perhaps trying to preserve. Part of working on all these subjects, though, is that you have teachers who, alive or dead, who lived through one or both of these kinds of regimes. And that helps me to see that this can happen to people like us, because if I can learn from them and I can talk to you, you know, and your listeners, that's people like us. And then since I've become a professional historian and a professor myself, I've had my own students, and some of them are from Eastern Europe, where in the last 25 years, democracy has not been advancing, but rather in general receding. And I've been trying to learn from their experience as well, as they take risks themselves to try to preserve things they think are worth defending.
So, I mean, if I understand you, there's not necessarily, I guess, preconditions before one moves from a society that has more pluralistic institutions. It's almost the natural tendency for these things to fall apart. But are there, I mean, but with that said, are there, you know, I guess, canaries in the coal mine for that you can draw a consistent picture or I guess context regardless that fits in most of these situations?
Yeah, I mean, so that what history I think helps us to do is to see both some of the big conditions or the anterior conditions that make the collapse of republics more likely, and simultaneously to see how much individual action matters. So history is about responsibility, but our responsibility is only coherent if we have some sense of the larger frameworks within which we're working. So, you know, when I describe in the book, I try to describe moments or patterns so that we can see what's coming. But at the moment where you see what's coming, you're also able to do something about it. The book is meant to work both ways. So to give a classic example, the use of terrorism in regime changes. It's since the Reichstag fire in Germany in 1933, tyrants around the world have seen a terrorist incident as an opportunity to transform a regime quickly. And indeed, this kind of thing is as old as time. You know, Madison talks about how our republic could be destroyed, as he puts it, you know, on some favorable emergency. So the notion that something shocking happens and that therefore you can change the system is a fundamental one to regime change. If you know that that's historically true, then you can sniff it out in advance. You can notice when your leaders are talking perhaps a little bit too often about terrorism and extremism, or using words like exception and words like emergency. You can be alert so that, God forbid, when something terrible happens, you don't get caught up in the automatic cycle, which says that in order to have safety, you have to give up freedom. So, but yeah, I mean, if you're asking me about 2016, I mean, there were some pretty obvious things in the character of Mr. Trump. I mean, the way that he ran his rallies, you know, throwing people out of them, the way that he spoke, which comes right out of the fascist playbook, the appeal that private security details seem to have to him are quite extraordinary, but also, you know, the general way that he handled the problem of globalization. Far right and far left politics in the early 20th centuries were ways of handling globalization and its challenges. What the far right does is that it puts a face on globalization. It says, rather than a set of objective problems that we have to address, globalization has a face, has a personality, right? And so for the Nazis, that was a Jewish face. But it can be done in different ways. You can say, you know, it's the Mexicans, the Chinese, whatever, the Muslims. And that's, you know, that's a classic form of politics. You know, rather than saying we can actually deal with this as a society or as a political system, we're going to start blaming people. And then that blame then becomes a way of changing the way politics works from within.
Let me just I want to go back just to what you were saying, which I think sort of pertains to chapter five about being aware of how like a terrorist attack could be used. I mean, to me, the most recent, I mean, a great example of that, it seems to me, is post 2001 in this country, post 9/11. I mean, we obviously did not move to some type of tyranny, but we certainly changed, and we certainly the relationship between civil rights as a matter of policy. I mean, maybe we were doing a lot of this stuff beforehand, but in terms of what was acceptable and expected, and it changed not only in terms of what our government did, it also seems to me it changed in terms of what our citizenry expected. Is that your sense as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think we have to look critically at 9/11 or take the opportunity to look critically at ourselves after 9/11, because everything that you say is true, and everything that you say is true, even though the leaders that we had at the time are not as bad, in my judgment, as the leaders who we have now. So many, you know, we got used to trading freedom for safety. We got used to thinking that was an automatic equation. We got used to, you know, thinking about terrorism at the top of our list. We got used to thinking of terrorism as a justification for doing unrelated things like invading unrelated countries, for example, which has caused us no end of trouble. Not just us, of course, above all the people who we have hurt and killed in the process. But I think what we need to do now is say, you know, 9/11 was a chance for us to learn not to make the same mistake again. Because I think, you know, for all the problems that the Bush-Cheney team brought, they didn't blame those incidents of terrorism on all Muslims, and they didn't try for some kind of general state of emergency in the U.S. I think the next time around, it's pretty likely that that's what we would be looking at. You know, and we need to be aware, you know, we need to learn from that example of our own failings, of the way that we are just as vulnerable, maybe more vulnerable to this kind of politics than other people, and be self-aware when the moment comes around again.
All right. So you cite Trump and I guess, you know, the way that he was presenting himself, and we can see plenty of examples of it. I mean, I think we saw, you know, sort of just where his sort of personal affinity lies just from the way that he got along with basically the autocrats on this trip, as opposed to the more popularly elected people. But what about the context in terms of the population? Like, how much does that play into it? Because when we use Germany as an example, or when we use like the rise of Putin, for example, it seems to me there are specific, we see specific qualities in Germany. One third of the population is is unemployed. The national psyche has been very damaged, and democracy has not been around for very long at that point. In Germany's history, in Russia, there was a sense of, you know, we would like some order again. I mean, how do you make that comparison in terms of where the American public is versus in those other situations?
So I'll make the comparison, but before I do that, I want to point out that I think history needs to work for us in a different way. So it's pretty easy for us to dismiss the comparisons by finding something which is different. And I tend to think, I mean, as a professional historian, I'm very glad to catalog the differences. As a citizen, I tend to think that we need to turn it around and look at those as moments where we can learn something. So we could say, sure, there are many differences between us and Russia in the 90s, but one similarity is that Russia had a leader who seemed to think that terrorism is an opportunity to consolidate power. Or we could say there are many differences between us and Germans in the 1930s. Oh, but look, Germans in the 1930s had a certain tendency to give up rights when there was a terrorist attack. Maybe that's not so similar. That's not so dissimilar from us. So, and then taking it even the next step, why don't we say people in Germany and Russia might sometimes be more observant than we were, and have experiences precisely that we haven't had, or at least haven't had yet, and have left an interesting record of it. And that's what I try to do. In the book, I try to excavate the brilliant people who generously left behind their thoughts about how to deal with these situations. The whole point being that if we have their experience, we can act faster and maybe, you know, avoid having the very same experiences ourselves. Now, all that said, I mean, I'm afraid there are certain similarities as well as differences. One of them, although in some minor key, is that there is a great deal of dissatisfaction with globalization in the United States, which is a common point of the 1930s in Germany and in the 1990s in Russia. In Russia, capitalism was, or whatever you want to call it, the free market, was discredited by the fact that it came in very quickly and without the rule of law, allowing huge accumulation of wealth. The fact that we have tremendous accumulation of wealth in this country is also a concern. And now we've gotten ourselves to the point where we now have deliberately elected an oligarch who actually likes the Russian system. And as you say, I think would feel more comfortable with that kind of a system than with the kind where he has to actually legitimate himself by way of following the law or having regular elections. With Germany, it's true. We don't have the massive unemployment that Germany had. That's true. But we do have tremendous underemployment. And we do have the sense in big parts of the country, including in Appalachia, among a lot of men especially, who have the sense that their life is not turning out the way that they expected, and they're not sure that they can do anything about it. And in that situation, charismatic politicians, and Mr. Trump, to give him credit where credit is due, was that, seemed to offer a kind of shortcut. Right, a way of saying it looks like life is failing, but I've got a way from jumping from here to victory. I've got a way from jumping from where you think you are into some kind of grand success or winning, as the president likes to say. And in that little way, I mean, I don't want to overdo it, but in that little way, Mr. Trump and Adolf Hitler are similar. I mean, both of them were people who weren't really successes in life, but who managed to put themselves in front of people who were struggling and say, I've got the answers. I've got a shortcut. I can make it all work out very quickly. And it's in situations where people feel vulnerable and don't see the possibility for social advancement that kind of a message has a certain resonance. So you don't want to overdo it, but I think it's helpful to try to use history not to, you know, make ourselves feel better, but to learn the lessons that can help us do ourselves better.
I will say that, the reason why I mean, I have some skepticism about this, but I also, you know, can't help but think about, you know, they say the number one reason why people drown is because they can't really conceive that they're drowning, and they don't wave, and they just basically before it's too late. And I guess I worry about that. And, you know, I had seen your Facebook post, I guess, right after the election. From your perspective, have you seen anything that has made you more or less alarmed or that you perceive that people are doing more or less well, relative to that, to those initial thoughts you had 6-7 months ago?
Yeah, let me first fasten on your point about time and about drowning, because I think it's actually a really good point. The reason why lesson number one, don't obey in advance, is lesson number one, is that if you don't get that one right, then you can forget about the rest. So, you know, don't obey in advance is one of the things historians agree about from the 1930s in Germany and other authoritarian regime changes, that it's important not to give your consent. It's important to, you know, at critical moments like the one we're in now, to stop and decide what you think is important and just be a stick in the mud for a while and not drift. And that gives you a chance then to do other things later on. If you blow that one, if you blow lesson one, if you obey in advance, if you just adjust sort of semi-consciously to the new reality, then you allow yourself to change psychologically. You know, you basically say, you know, to use your analogy, I'm not drowning, and then you can drown. And politically, you then use up, you consume, you waste the moment where your actions actually made a difference. So, I mean, it's a historical point that I'm kind of obsessed with, but I think I'm right. It's very important to front load action. And even if you're not sure exactly where things are going, and, you know, and by the way, like, the lessons that are in the book are all sort of healthy, normal, civic things to do.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And well,
yeah.
well give yeah. me, give us an example of what it means to obey in advance.
Okay. So, that's good. So, I mean, let me just first talk about how normal it is to obey in advance. Right. Like, you know, you and I had an agreement that we were going to talk at a certain time. You know, there's a convention that you ask questions and I answer them. When I go to work, I say hello to people as I walk in. I mean, there are all these conventions that we follow all the time. If I'm in a meeting and somebody else is chairing it, you know, I'm going to let them set the tone. We do these things all the time. And that's sociologically normal. In order to become political people, or in order to become citizens of a republic, the ability you have to have is to notice when something is politically crucial, like when you're in a moment where it's actually not appropriate to obey in advance. So to give examples of what it actually looks like, I'll give you an example from 2017. If you're in the, which is a true example, you know, if you're in the Trump administration and you're responsible for, you know, issues having to do with human rights, and there is no change in policy, right? But maybe you think, well, I should probably keep my head down for a while, right? Like that's in the civil service. Or, you know, to go back dramatically into the past, if it's Germany in 1933, and you notice that other people are not talking to Jews, and then you just kind of go along and you make an excuse like I was never that real close with him or whatever, then you're obeying in advance. And when you do that, you're instructing, you know, whether it's the more benign or whether it's the more malign example, what you're doing is you're instructing power of what it can do. Because the dirty little secret of authoritarian regimes, especially at the beginning, is they're not that powerful at the beginning. They send out signals to us, and we react or don't react, you know, and as we react, we teach them what they can do. And then they get more powerful by learning, you know, which things we'll respond to, which things we'll go along with.
That's interesting. And so it's the difficulty of that is I am going out on a limb and I don't know if I necessarily need to do this. Right. I mean, that's basically it. If I'm going to buck certain trends, if I go out and protest against the immigration ban, and risk, you know, protesting that when it could very well be that the courts will strike it down. That is the sort of the trap you can fall into.
Yeah, that's a great description of the trap, because if you think, I mean, so like there's some logical possibilities here. Like one is that nothing bad is going to happen. Okay. If nothing bad is going to happen, it's not going to hurt to protest. It's just going to make you a better citizen and a better example for your neighbors and your children or whatever. So, you know, that there goes that objection. Then, you know, there's the possibility that somebody else will take care of it. Well, they might, but the cycle that you get in is everybody thinks somebody else is going to take care of it. And the institutions will rescue us is the classic thing. Like when I wrote the post way back in November, it was only a few hours after the election, but Americans were already saying, oh, our institutions will protect us. And the answer to that is they will only protect us if we show, some of them might, but only if we show them how, and only if we bolster them, and only if we get out ahead and set a certain kind of example. So, I mean, I don't think the judges striking them down and us protesting are actually two discrete events. I think there's a way in which we're all breathing the same political atmosphere, and every little thing we do in one place, it tends to have an effect, I think probably greater than we think in other places.
And we should say that you could include in that notion of institutions sort of controlling Trump would be, I mean, the one I heard from people who didn't seem to be as concerned as I was like the establishment Republicans will control him. And, you know, perhaps to a certain extent I wouldn't say they have. I think that, you know, to the extent that anybody's any institutions are doing it are like, the intelligence services and perhaps the military. But there's a problem with that, too, isn't there? I mean, that we're in a position where, to a large extent, much of Trump's I mean, and I will say that there's been a lot of constraint, I think, on what's happening politically from those people who are coming out to town halls. But much of what is, at least within the context of Washington proper, hurting Trump politically, it seems to me, and sort of undercutting his administration's ability to function on some basic levels, are leaks that we're getting from intelligence agencies and from and then also, I think, exertion of influence from military officials. But it seems to me that's also dangerous, too, in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, we have to kind of recognize where we are. It'd be nice if it would be nice if the legislature were providing a check, but it's basically not.
I think, on the contrary, there's a very good argument that some of the leadership, I mean, Nunes had to step down, right? I mean, there's, I think they are accomplices in something, at the very least, in trying to quash investigations.
Yeah, I mean, so that's how the story all kind of ties together. I mean, the Republicans don't, you know, I mean, for me, like, if there's a chance that the president is a traitor, you would then drop everything, you know, as a congressman or congresswoman, and you would get that sorted out, and then you could move on to other, you know, less pressing policy obligations. But I think the whole story ties together because, I mean, if the legislature thinks it's okay that the president might be a traitor because that way they'll have some time to pass tax cuts or whatever, then you are left with other institutions and one may be uncomfortable. I mean, I am, you know, I don't like that we're in a situation where we're counting, you know, we're basically counting on, you know, the intelligence agencies to control the generals, and we're counting on the generals to control the kleptocrats, and we're counting on the kleptocrats to control the fascists. That's not great, but it's where we are. But the thread running through it all is the Russia scandal. I mean, you know, it's the FBI and the CIA and the other intelligence agencies are not just engaged in some, you know, random activity resisting the president. They've been doubly targeted. I mean, first, from their point of view, they lost the cyber war in 2016 to a hostile foreign power, right? Which is, I think that's also my point of view. And second, the person who came to power, and partly as a result of Russia's interference in our elections, has been explicitly hostile to them. Comparing them to Nazis, you know, making a ridiculous appearance in the CIA, firing the director of the FBI, inappropriately asking the heads of other intelligence agencies to declare publicly that he's not a subject of investigation, demanding loyalty, you know, which is that's bad news. I mean, that's, you know, in 1934, Hitler demands specifically loyalty from comparable institutions because loyalty is the way that you jump from being a rule of law state to being something else. Loyalty is what makes you not the head of government or head of state, but the leader. You know, that's the German word, the Führer. You're the Führer the moment that it's loyalty rather than law.
Right.
That counts. So, I mean, it's not just that they're kind of in the way, you know, there's a reason why this is happening. And the reason transcends Native American developments. You know, there are things about Russia that we have to find out before any of this is going to make sense. And so, I mean, the concept I would focus on would be the rule of law. You know, I mean, we can maybe, many of us can agree that we should figure out where the president or members of his campaign broke laws in order to be elected.
I want to touch on just a couple of the lessons, but let me ask you another general question. Does our polarization help? I mean, it seems to me that the almost the reflexive partisanship that some people have polarization is actually helpful in this situation because it inhibits, I think, people's inclination to obey in advance, which is your first tip.
Wow. Okay. I've just found a perspective which is like more skeptical than my own. That's a good point, I guess. I mean, I think you're probably right, but I mean, the counter argument would be something like this: Democrats or people on the left, when they get into their own silos, they can also start to believe things that aren't true, right? So the Russia story is true. There, you know, it's true that his first foreign policy speech was written by somebody on the Russian payroll. It's true that his first Russia advisor was on the Russian payroll. It's true that his campaign manager was somebody who once pitched to Putin the idea of softening up American democracy for Russian influence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's something strange there. However, if you get too much in your own silo, there are also plenty of things out there about Russia which aren't true, or right, which are just speculation, but which are brain candy now for a certain part of us. And, you know, for another part of us, there's a whole lot of other brain candy which gets kicked around. And so, I mean, I think there's probably something in what you say, but I also, I mean, one of the gists of the book is that everybody, I mean, has to spend less time on the internet and more time in personal conversation, not because we persuade ourselves, but because we persuade one another, because we remind one another that we're all real, you know, because when you're on the internet, it's very easy to think like I'm right and the rest of them are just the enemies and they have bad faith, right? And there are plenty of people out there with bad faith, but I think the mechanism of all this is very important. I mean, I think political polarization on values is natural. What I worry about is political polarization based on fiction, where way too much of the country is down in a place where they're making decisions about the real world on the basis of stuff which just isn't true, right? And that, you know, that level of factual polarization is part of the drive towards authoritarianism ultimately, because if we don't have to agree about values, right? I mean, you might think justice is more important and I might think, you know, whatever, I might think freedom is more important. But if we don't agree that there are facts about the US of A, then it's very hard for us to be a political community.
Well, I agree with that. And I think that there is a certainly this is a phenomena on the left, but it's nowhere near. I mean, the fact is that, even if everybody jumped off the internet tomorrow, there's still a huge segment of the population that has been growing up on, frankly, right-wing radio and Fox News, both not on the internet, where you would find a narrative ranging from Vince Foster and direct mail for that matter at this point, ranging from, you know, Vince Foster was murdered right up to Seth Rich was murdered, by the Clintons. And that would exist almost coincident of the internet. It's true, I think, that, you know, you have sort of on the left, like the Louise Mensch's, if you will, who are reporting all sorts of fantastical things, some stuff that may, you know, prove to be accurate, but largely fantastical. But that to me seems like a much more narrow phenomena. I guess what I'm talking about when I talk about polarization is not necessarily an immediate rush to believe, unfounded, maybe they will be, but, theories on what's going on, but rather a general awareness of where we've been in terms of different political parties for the past two decades. I mean, in 2002, the Republican Party is saying that Max Cleland, a guy who lost half his limbs in service of this country, was basically Osama bin Laden, right? I mean, this is, at some levels, this is how we got a Donald Trump, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think that the way that we get out of this, though, has to involve a partisanship which is not just bipartisanship. So, I mean, I'm willing to run down that whole catalog with you as well, and I'm sure we'd largely agree. But I don't, like, when we think about where we want to be in 2018 or 2028, it's not going to be like the two partisan groups we had in 2016. I think that the people who find a way out of where we are now in 2017 are also going to be the people who readjust the Democratic Party, broaden the Democratic Party, change the actual discussion. I mean, in my own view, like we've tilted so far that it's not just a matter of like particular untruths or particular injustices to people, horrifying as the one you mentioned is. It's rather that I think the whole axis of politics in the West is now turning not so much on right and left, but on facts and anti-facts. And that, you know, the Russian model is not, although Russia is a right-wing regime and supports the far right internationally, the fundamental way Russia works is by managing extreme economic inequality by way of the production of alternative reality. And that's what's catching on here. And that's the thing I think fundamentally one has to be against. And that didn't exist back in 2002, right? So I think like the new, whatever it is, the new left, you know, or the new Democratic Party is going to have to learn to function as the factual side and be the interesting factual side, which has more to offer than the alternative reality side. I agree with you. The alternative reality has come up through other technologies.
But I guess I'm a little confused because, I mean, having been, you know, sort of like professionally engaged in that argument since, you know, 2004, the biggest problem.
But maybe you're not confused. Maybe you're just right. But anyway.
Well, no. Oh, okay. No, but I want to be clear on what you're saying in terms of like what, you know, because it seems to me that, that broadly speaking, the way that the Democratic Party and the left, and it was a different left in 2004 than it is today, and in many respects, you know, the left has moved to the left in this country, it seems to me, but that the biggest argument was like we have the facts on our side, and while those of us who believe that we had the facts on our side kept talking about the facts, this alternate reality was building. And in some respects, there was things that were, these alternate realities became more functional for people who ostensibly should have had a better and answer from the left even. So I'm talking about, you know, we have stagnating wages, for instance, and we have rising insurance costs, and we're that theoretically the left maybe did not provide a robust enough answer, but it was one that was at least attempting to address it. And I think it's, you know, in most instances, and it was all based on facts, right? I mean, there was no books about income inequality coming out of conservative think tanks 5-10 years ago. There was plenty coming out on the left. And that was the reality, right? That supposedly has brought about Trump. I mean, so I don't understand like where, if, I mean, and the things I love about your 20 tips is that they are things that I think that like we should be doing even not in a time where we're worried about this type of thing, largely speaking, that we should be engaging in our political process. But how does simply adhering to a specific story that is very fact-based. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be fact-based, but I mean, how does that in and of itself do enough where it seems to me there needs to be actually a change in solutions offered to overcome the more facile ones?
Yeah, no, I think the more you talk, I mean, the more we agree. So with the facts, there's a negative point here, which is that if you give up on factuality, then you're giving up on your democratic republic and your rule of law, right? I mean, this is at the most fundamental level of what kind of system you have. If you give up on there being facts, then it's just a question of what kind of authoritarianism comes next, because you're not going to preserve a rule of law state, because without some sense of factuality, you can't keep up trust, and without trust, you can't have rule of law, and without rule of law, you can't have democracy. That's at the base level of the system. That's a different question of, do you win as a political party with the facts? Mm. No, you can lose. I mean, you can lose, you will lose. But since you don't have any choice but to be factual, the question then becomes, how can you be both interesting and factual, right? And much of the point of the book, you know, and I yield to your experience on American politics, right? Remember, you're talking to a European historian. But much of the point of the book is how one can engage in everyday politics, right? I mean, one of the points of the book is about small talk and eye contact. And I think that is something that maybe, you know, if we have to talk about the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party could be a little bit better at, because when the Democratic Party talks about facts, it's too often been like facts on an average, right? So when Hillary Clinton says America's right. great now, yes. Yeah, sure, on an average it is, but not in a whole bunch of counties in Ohio that matter, not just right. electorally, but because real people live there. And when the Democratic Party talks about facts, and this is true of the left in general, I mean, there's a certain tendency to think, because we have the facts, therefore you're wrong. And often there's something in somebody else's crazy, what seems like a crazy narrative, there's something in it which is actually right. I mean, maybe most of it's wrong, but there's something in it which is, I mean, I'm not talking about like Vince Foster narratives or pizza narratives, but I mean, there's something in it which actually reflects a point of view which we just haven't seen, right? And I mean, that correlates to the fact that the Republican Party actually is a grassroots nationwide organization. And it's much less hard. It's harder to characterize the Democratic Party in that way. I think Democratic Party has relied too much on abstractions like demography and abstractions like history, rather than like getting down and figuring out how to make its factual stories interesting on a local level. And that's a hell of a lot of hard work, and it's easy for me to say so. But I think something like that is going to have to happen.
All right, let me ask you then, finish on this question, because this is the one that I was sort of really pondering from. Does fighting against the possibility of going down an autocratic road, does that inhibit the development of that other story you're talking about, basically providing a political agenda that addresses some more meaningful things for people? Are those two things in conflict? I mean, can you do both of them at the same time? And I guess, you know, it's becoming less of an issue to me, but early on you had someone like Bernie Sanders saying, like, I'm going to work with Donald Trump on specific issues that if he delivers. So if he had come out, and, you know, to a certain extent, you know, I've read pieces where I think Rick Perlstein wrote, Donald Trump's too stupid to be a full-on autocrat, more or less. I mean, had he come out with an infrastructure bill, let's say, early on, that was actually a legitimate infrastructure bill, that wasn't just simply a way for privatization, I think, and I think that it would have been probably correct to do. There would have been a lot of support from the left for that. Yet, simultaneously, he could still be doing all the other things that promote an autocratic, tyrannical type of rule. I mean, is there a danger that that those two things are in conflict, or that they're not?
Well, I mean, there are all kinds of things to say about the question, right? I mean, the classic model of National Socialism is precisely socialism, but only for us and not for the outsiders among us. So not for the disabled, not for the Jews, not for the foreigners, right? But the state works for us, the people, das Volk, you know, and Trump, when Trump talks about the people, he means the same thing. He doesn't mean all people. He means just us. So, you know, that is the National Socialist model. And that's something where I think that Mr. Bannon, for example, is quite close to something like that.
Right. They call him a civic nationalist or nationalist civic, as opposed to basically white supremacist.
But you kind of know what he means. And it's true that they couldn't get something like that through. And that may be, you know, going back to our earlier part of the conversation, a correction to both of us, because the fact that there are so many, that this, you know, quote unquote libertarianism is so important in Congress makes things like that hard. Right. But I mean, my basic answer to your question is, as citizens, no. I mean, for you and me, and for citizens and for people in the United States, no, there's no conflict between resisting tyranny and creating a broader sense of imagination about what good policy is going to be. I think they're actually the same thing. I think we're only going to get through the next couple of years if we practice the kinds of habits that would be the same habits that would, you know, the same habits which would get us talking to one another, and thereby fashioning the better narratives, as we were talking about, coming up with the policies that make sense in pockets of the country where policy has stopped making sense. I really honestly do think that it's all the same thing, and that there's a broad way in which, you know, just everyday behavior makes us the kinds of people who are going to do better in 2 years and in 4 years down the line. So no, I absolutely don't think there's any contradiction. On the contrary, I think it's really the same. It's the same palette of activity.
Professor Timothy Snyder, the book is On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Check out the book. It's a quick read, and the 20 lessons, I think, are great lessons to practice even when you may not be concerned that we are spiraling down into a autocratic, tyrannical situation. I think these are great things to be doing just as a citizen and engaging in politics. And if it has the added bonus that in the event that, for me, the biggest fear I have had is what happens in this context if we have another 9/11. And just even in the context of that attack that we had on Syria, the ability of the center to immediately move to the most aggressive, war-espousing position is shocking. In fact, today is the 14th anniversary of the "suck on this" quote from Thomas Friedman. And maybe in that context, we should, play it. Just a reminder for people, in 2003. He was on Charlie Rose, and he was explaining why we had to go. And this is 2 months after, 3 months after the invasion, 2 months after the invasion, two and a half, in May of 2003. And he is explaining why we had to go into Iraq. It was Thomas Friedman's cheerleading, which I think... you can never point to one thing, but the number of liberals, non-Bush supporting people, I should say, who cited Thomas Friedman as this being the thing to do was astonishing. And I think that's why we paid so much attention to this. But here he is with Charlie Rose. And it's really important to hear this because for people maybe Matt's age, maybe they don't even remember who Thomas Friedman was. But he was sort of the
I got Hot Earth. What is his book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded? I got that for Christmas from my uncle once.
Exactly.
Did you read it?
This was sort of like the non-politically engaged person's vision of like what people who talk about politics should be. Listen to this now. I mean, it didn't work so well then from my perspective, but time has not been kind to this exchange. And that's why I think Thomas Friedman like literally tries to get this pulled down every time it goes up. But here it is.
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace,
pause.
Was it worth doing?
Understand, the war is over, difficulty with the peace. This was 14 years ago, ladies and gentlemen.
Charlie Rose not doing so well in this clip either.
Not doing so well in this clip either. Go ahead.
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. And it's interesting to talk about it here in Silicon Valley because
pause
I think looking back.
Just to explain, they're in one of those, they're in Silicon Valley and, Thomas Friedman wants to make some type of analogy, and he does, and it's really uncomfortable. So this is like a live, I think, presentation on stage in front of, I think, but nevertheless.
At the 1990s, I can identify that there are actually three bubbles of the 1990s. There was the NASDAQ bubble. There was the corporate governance bubble. And lastly, there was what I would call the terrorism bubble. And the first two were based on creative accounting. The last was based on moral creative accounting. Mm. The terrorism bubble that basically built up over the 1990s said, flying airplanes into the World Trade Center, that's okay. Wrapping yourself with dynamite and blowing up Israelis in a pizza parlor, that's okay. Because we're weak and they're strong and the weak have a different morality. Having your preachers say that's okay, that's okay. Having your charities raise money for people who do these kinds of things, that's okay. And having your press call people who do these kind of things martyrs, that's okay. And that built up as a bubble, Charlie. And 9/11 to me was the peak of that bubble. And what we learned on 9/11 in a gut way was that that bubble was a fundamental threat to our open society. Because there is no wall high enough, no INS agent smart enough, no metal detector efficient enough to protect an open society from people motivated by that bubble. And what we needed to do was go over to that part of the world, I'm afraid, and burst that bubble. We needed to go over there, basically, take out a very big stick, right in the heart of that world, and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. Because part of that bubble said, we've got you. This bubble is actually going to level the balance of power between us and you because we don't care about money. We're ready to sacrifice, and all you care about are your stock options and your Hummers. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this, okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. That's the real truth. And the message.
We hit Iraq because we could. Suck on this. I have to say, one of the proudest moments in my my political punditry career was probably 8 years after that, being on a panel with Thomas Friedman, with Dylan Radigan, talking about income inequality and looking across and saying, but aren't we just... I mean, aren't we in a situation where the 1% is basically just saying to the rest of us, suck on this? And I kept saying something else. And just, I looked to Radigan and I looked back and he was just staring at me, trying to figure out, because apparently, I mean, like I say, they had this, they kept pulling this down. And I heard stories of people going up to Friedman at party and saying stuff like that. And he would just get enraged. And he just kept looking at me throughout the entire segment, the remaining of the segment, just sort of just trying to see. And I just had this sort of like, you know.
Suck on this, Mr. Friedman. Why are you looking at me so strange?
It's so weird that you would do that.
Incredible so. About
it,
that
It was
whole...
like just the idea that he went home that night and was like,
That
it's amazing that he actually talks like he writes the same level. Because I always thought of Suck on This. I haven't seen the whole clip in a while. But Suck on This, in some ways, as disgusting as it is like the clearest thing he's ever communicated. But like watching the preamble.
That was
like,
a hell of a
there's
preamble.
There's three different bubbles. And there's a moral bubble. And then just the sliding in of like, no, Pakistan had a nuke. And we were relying on Pakistan for fueling
Afghanistan. He said we could have, not that we could have actually in practice. He's saying that was, if you wanted to target somebody who was responsible, you could have gone there. But we went to Iraq because we could.
We just could. It was the place. The suck yes. on this opportunity. Okay, yes. I understand that.
Because Pakistan would have said, well, actually, no, you suck on this.
Yeah, we have thing you suck on, okay?
And I should also tell people in the context that Hummers were these big vehicles that were for sale. I don't know. People know what Humvees are? I mean, like,
isn't it like it's like a modern? That was well, a, it's a military vehicle.
They marketed the military Humvees. And you still see a couple going around, but not the big
sounds ones. Like a moral bubble.
Right. It's a moral bubble.
There's three types of bubbles that occurred. That is
right.
How that did clip, this guy?
It actually gives me hope for a future in writing things that make sense.
Well, the other part of that is you have to be married to a billionaire heiress to be able to feel the confidence to go out and present.
Yeah,
that
the confidence in that. Like, if I started spinning anything that convoluted, I would just be quiet after like 15 seconds.
To be honest, though, in my mind, I'm thinking about writing, and in if I was on any show, I'm sure that.
Yeah, but his writing is not.
No, no, but that's the point. His writing sounds exactly the same.
I feel confident that, yes. That I can do much, much better.
You need to start thinking of slogans, though, that can get gobbled up.
I need a slogan?
That's what made his career.
Yeah, hot earth and crowded.
You know, he makes ridiculous slogans that get picked up by middle managers at, like, retreats. Like, that. Those are his whole book. Like,
hang in there with the cat that's hanging?
No, like.
More like thinking out of the box.
This is, no, like. We live in the triple connectivity era,
right?
Like that type of thing. Right. Like
I can make up those so easily because
do it. All right,
I can make up 100 tonight because they're so funny. They're so ridiculous.
We'll bring them. Put them on tomorrow.
What if instead of telling time, we listen to it?
See, that's legitimately deeper
yes.
than Thomas Friedman. That's like a respectable stoner thought.
All right, well, I am listening to Time, and Time is saying, what the heck are you doing, buddy? you got way late. Folks, it is your membership that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you buy your stuff through Amazon or Jet.com, check out our affiliate links at MajorityReportKickback.com. You click on that link, you purchase your goods, you will notice no difference, but we will get a little kickback. See you in the fun half.